Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Don't look now, but Jay Powell? He's making the Fed boring again. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 11th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, ordinarily, on a day like today, when the Federal Reserve wraps up one of its interest rate meetings, we would play you some audio of the incumbent chair of the Board of Governors explaining why the central bank did this thing or that thing with interest rates. Today, though, not. Because fundamentally, the incumbent chair in question, one Jay Powell, didn't say anything new. No move in interest rates. Economy's fine. He's not worried about inflation. Nothing to see here. Move along. Status quo. Status quo. However, now that 2019 is in the books monetary policy-wise and the Fed has pretty much done a U-turn from where it was a year ago on what this economy could bear, it might be time to ask some hard questions of Chair Powell et al. Neil Irwin has been asking some of them in his coverage of the economy for the New York Times. Neil, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks, Kai.
Much as one hates to, think ill of the Federal Reserve, is it possible, given what has happened this year, and the past couple, actually, that maybe the Fed has just been wrong for a while now?
I mean, it's not just possible. It's they're almost admitting it. They're almost acknowledging it with their actions. You know, if you go back a couple of years, they thought that they were going to have to keep raising interest rates, a lot more than they have. Yeah. They thought that unemployment rate could not fall very low. And those things have both turned out to be wrong.
This is all about the economy's potential, right? It's what could have been had things been different.
Right. There's the question of how many people have to be unemployed, right? So there's always going to be some people in a dynamic economy who are between jobs, who are going from one sector to the next, moving around. But how many of those people are there? And at one time, the kind of conventional wisdom in the economics field was that it was, 5, 6, maybe more percent of the labor force. Now we're at 3.5% unemployment, and there's nothing bad happening. There's no inflation. There's none of the bad stuff that's supposed to happen if you go too low has materialized. That means maybe we could have been more ambitious all along, and maybe the unemployment rate actually can be a lot lower.
And then the costs of that have been what?
Well, the question is, could we have gotten here faster? You know, we're at 3.5% unemployment now. It took us 10 years to get there, 11 years in this expansion. If the Fed had not raised rates as much as they had, if Congress had not been so worried about reducing deficits, might we have gotten to 3.5% unemployment years ago? And would there be millions of people who have been earning an income and having a better quality of life for years now who instead took that long to find a job?
I don't want to make too much of the fact that Jay Powell's not an economist, because he's not. We've talked about this on the program. But is it possible that this change of tone in the Fed is happening because he's not a PhD economist?
I think it helps. I think he's not tethered to this wisdom that's kind of the received idea of how the economy works, this relationship between unemployment and inflation that a lot of kind of old school macroeconomists take to their graves. They think of it as kind of the underlying fundamental relationship for understanding how the economy works. Jay Powell, as you say, he's a business guy. He's been learning a lot of economics over the last decade, but it's not as if he comes out of a PhD kind of background. He looks at the world around him and says, well, shoot, we're seeing unemployment fall month after month after month, and no inflation seems to result. Nothing bad seems to be happening because of that. Let's see how low we can go.
Well, so play that out for me now. I mean, if the Fed's been wrong for the past, decade, picking a number, what happens in the next decade? I mean, is there like upside potential to be realized?
I think what we're seeing now is they want to figure out just how good the economy can get. We heard this message from Chairman Powell in the most recent press conference that they want to wait until there's real evidence of inflation, persistent inflation, before they raise rates. That was not the tone as recently as a year ago. Just 1 year ago, they were saying, oh yeah, we're not just raising rates again, which they did. We're going to raise two more times this year, we think. Who knows how far we're going to go. Now they're saying, let's just sit on our hands. Let's see how how much this economy can rev, how hot that engine can get.
don't do something, just sit there. Neil Irwin, he covers the economy for the New York Times. He writes about it, too, most recently in a book that we had him on the program for called How to Win in a Winner-Take-All World. Neil, thanks a lot. I appreciate it, as always.
Thanks, Scott.
Traders got a little bump on the Fed news, but otherwise not a whole lot going on in equities. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The benchmark American crude West Texas Intermediate fell about a half a buck today, closed at $58.76 a barrel. I mentioned that on the way to this. Chevron, this economy's second biggest fossil fuel producer, marked down the value of its underground assets by $10 billion this week. Even for an oil company, that's real money. And it's a sign that oil and natural gas prices might stay low-ish for a while. Because as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, the energy world is coming to the realization that long-term, a lot of those underground assets might never be drilled to the surface.
When you have a glut of something, the price of that something, you know, it sags. That's been happening for years with natural gas in what's called the Marcellus Shale Formation in the eastern U.S. Basement prices are bad news for drillers like Chevron. Here's economist Ed Herz at the University of Houston.
Chevron bought into the Marcellus. Unfortunately, lots of people have been doing the same, and so the supply has outstripped the demand.
So Chevron cut the value of its investment there. And write-downs have happened in oil, too, at BP, Schlumberger, Repsol. Amy Myers Jaffe at the Council on Foreign Relations says this reflects a longer-term reality as the world tries to move on from fossil fuels, that the buyers may never come.
If you start to question whether oil demand will peak, it's already declining in Europe, and now it's looking more likely that it could peak in China.
She says all this upends a long-term assumption in the business, that you could always wait out low prices and then produce when prices come back.
There are going to be oil and gas reserves that just can't be produced. And part of that pressure is climate change, and part of that has to do with new innovative technologies that are going to reduce the need for oil.
For instance, electric cars. So some energy companies are trying to sell assets sooner rather than later. Ed Herz says that's what Saudi Arabia's oil giant Aramco did when it went public this week, turn reserves into cash while they still hold value. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in oil, Dateline Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, shares of Saudi Aramco hit the 10% up limit when they started trading there today. That really is about all the time that story is worth. Only a sliver of the company's shares are trading, all and only on the Riyadh Stock Exchange. All right, moving on. This is day two of the signed but not yet ratified new North American Free Trade Regime, the USMCA. And while day one coverage was a whole lot of auto parts and biologic pharmaceuticals and environmental protections, there are some other things in that deal, you know. Like, for instance, it's going to be harder to sue technology companies. Specifically, it protects tech companies from being liable for what their users do. That's already the law here, but under the USMCA, as now written, it would apply in Mexico and Canada as well. Here's Marketplace's Sabri Benishwar.
In the U.S., if someone puts up a really vicious Yelp review of a restaurant, let's say, like really just wildly libelous and defamatory, that restaurant could sue the person who posted the review, but it couldn't successfully go after Yelp.
Liability for online speech lies with the speaker and not the platform.
Michael Petricone is with the Consumer Technology Association, which represents tech companies. This protection, it's referred to as Section 230, is very important to tech companies.
Well, 230 is the law that made the internet possible.
Baron Soka is president of Tech Freedom.
Sites like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, these things all exist because Section 230 has prevented these companies from being sued for everything that their users post and create.
The same protections are built into the USMCA. The idea is to extend a friendly business environment and free speech-friendly regulations from the U.S. into Canada and Mexico. But more and more, it's not how everyone in the U.S. wants the internet to work.
Section 230 right now is under attack.
Jeff Kossoff is a professor at the U.S. Naval Academy and has written a book about Section 230. Critics argue internet companies get too much protection and don't moderate users' content enough.
So you have a lot of people for different reasons, including members of Congress, saying that Section 230 has to be repealed or significantly amended.
That's led to some griping that the protections made it into the USMCA, but legal experts say Congress, if it wants to change U.S. law, still can. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
We do a thing on the program, one hopes you've heard it, called Conversations from the Corner Office. CEOs of one stripe or another, almost entirely people running big-ish for-profit companies. This month, though, something a little bit different. Nonprofits and charities, just as important as those big brands, but in a totally different way. Today, Habitat for Humanity may be one of the best-known not-for-profits out there, but perhaps known best due to a misunderstanding. Jonathan Reckford is the CEO of Habitat for Humanity, also this year an author of a book called Our Better Angels. Mr. Reckford, welcome to the program, sir.
Thanks, Kai. Great to be with you.
I think there are some things we need to clear up, first of all, about your business, your company, and how you guys work. I think probably everybody or many people think you just build houses and give them away. That is not, in fact, the case.
That is true. That's one of the biggest myths about Habitat. In fact, we're best known for two things that turn out not to be true. First, that we give away houses. We don't. We actually sell them to families who put in hundreds of hours of sweat equity helping build their homes and their neighbors' homes, and then they pay back an affordable mortgage, and we recycle those funds back into the same communities. The other is that President Carter started and runs Habitat, which is also not true, though he certainly put us on the map.
Yeah, for sure. And we'll get back to the former president in a minute. But a word here about you. Just ticking through your resume, Goldman Sachs, Marriott, the Walt Disney Corporation, Circuit City, how did you wind up running a nonprofit that does global work like you do?
You know, I think God has a sense of humor. My career in some ways never made complete sense. Great opportunities just kept coming along. But I had always planned on trying to learn in the private sector and then eventually take that to a mission that I could get really excited about. And looking back, all of those roles actually have turned out to be incredibly helpful.
Yeah. Can we talk labor market here for a minute? You depend almost entirely, I mean in overwhelming proportion, on volunteers to come help you do this good work. And yet the labor market that people get paid for is really, really tight. How do you convince people to give up their precious, precious time?
It's really interesting. Outside the U.S., we are much less dependent on volunteers because the ratio of volunteers, typically we have a lot of volunteers available in middle and high income countries, far fewer volunteers available in very low income countries. And so the constraint for us is actually not more volunteers, it's the land. And that's the underlying challenge here in the U.S. and around the world in our cities. And so for us, we could actually put more volunteers to work if we had more land.
This is a terrible way to frame this, and people will hear it and it will go right by them as they're driving down the freeway, and I'm going to get mean tweets and angry emails about it. But the affordable housing crisis is really an opportunity for you, both here and globally.
You know, it's a sad opportunity.
Yeah.
We look forward to the day when we can move on to something else because, as our mission says, everyone already has decent housing. But I would say it has gotten so bad that finally housing is higher on the visibility list. If you had asked 5 years ago, housing would rate maybe number eight on people's priority list. Even though if you asked somebody who didn't have good housing, it would be right at the top of the list. What's happened now is it's actually gotten so bad, I think, that middle-class families, their children can't afford housing. Mm-hmm. And so it suddenly has become visible. But it's been a crisis for a long time.
A thought here about the nuts and bolts of how you do what you do. You depend heavily, as you said, on corporate partnerships. Your brand, personified by, as you mentioned beforehand, former President Carter, is critically important. How do you capitalize on that and build on it in a way that doesn't betray the mission, right? Because you have to act in some ways as a for-profit growing enterprise, yet with this service mission.
You know, I think for us, the axiom I've used for years now is we want to be religious about our principles but not our tactics. So we want to stay focused on shelter. And to do that, that means we need the private sector and the public sector and the social sector working together, because it's so complex, Kai, as you know, to try to change hearts and minds. You live in the epicenter. You know, NIMBY is something that happens all over the world, not in my backyard. In California, it's banana. Yeah. Build absolutely nothing anywhere near anything. And so we have got to change hearts and minds in order to change policies so that we can build and increase the supply of affordable housing, or housing that is affordable for people.
Jonathan Reckford, he's the CEO of Habitat for Humanity International. His book out now is called Our Better Angels. Mr. Reckford, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Great to be with you, Kai. Thanks so much for having me.
We've got more of my conversation with Jonathan Reckford, including how you go about growing a global nonprofit, also Habitat's role in affordable housing advocacy, on our Corner Office podcast. Coming up,
a lot of folks are feeling that pressure to spend more than really they have to spend.
Ah, the holidays. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 29 points today, about a 0.1%, 27,911. The NASDAQ gained 37 points, 0.4%, 86.54. The S&P 500 up 9 points, about 0.2%, 31.41 there. Walgreens Boots Alliance stumbled 0.6% today after a downgrade from Wells Fargo. Healthcare insurer Cigna was also downgraded by Wells Fargo. Stock climbed just a tad, so, you know, we'll call that flat. Home Depot, a hammer, down 1.8% today. The home improvement chain issued a sales growth forecast for 2020 that missed expectations. Lowe's up 1% on the day. American Eagle Outfitters swooped down 6.5% after posting a disappointing profit and sales forecast. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.79%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
On Corner Office, you're going to hear stuff you're not going to hear anyplace else. Travel tips from Arne Sorensen of Marriott.
Always be on local time. Always get natural light. Always exercise.
This from YouTube's Susan Wojcicki.
It's great to see the impact that we can have and the responsibility that comes with that.
And Microsoft's Satya Nadella on why it's personal.
I mean, he's in a hospital bed managed with devices and software that we built.
Listen to my conversations with them and more on the Corner Office podcast.
Want to dive deeper into a story you hear on Marketplace? Visit our website at marketplace.org for extra content and analysis. From videos to explainers, we have you covered when it comes to understanding the economy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's election day tomorrow over in the UK. Brexit, as you know, is on the ballot again. 3.5 years it's been since the referendum. Tomorrow is the second general election since. But you take Brexit out of the equation for just a second, which is hard, I know, but work with me here. You take Brexit out, and given the way the two party leaders are talking, there's a case to be made that the inner workings of British capitalism are up for a vote. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson called the election because he'd lost his majority in Parliament and couldn't push through his exit deal for leaving the EU. His message on the campaign trail couldn't be clearer.
Do we want 2020 to be another year of defeatism and despair? No, we don't. Get Brexit done.
His main opponent, Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, wants this election to be about much, much more.
Today, we launch the most ambitious and radical campaign our country has ever seen.
Corbyn's plan? Renationalise the water, electricity, rail and mail services, confiscate 10% of the dividends paid out by large companies, make broadband free, institute a four-day work week, cap and control rents, and a great deal more besides.
We can rewrite the rules of our economy to work for the many, not the few. Ignore the wealthy and the powerful who tell you that's not possible. The future is ours to make. Together.
Corbyn's manifesto has dominated media coverage of the campaign.
The most important election of our lifetime is about more than just Brexit.
The party's poll rating has picked up. Many young voters, like Londoner Freddie Mason, are supporting Labour.
Public services are falling apart. There is a huge housing crisis, especially in London, where rent is astronomical. The Labour Party is offering sort of sensible alternatives.
The real election battleground is well away from London, in the Midlands and in the North, in marginal Labour-held but Brexit-supporting electoral districts. Like Stoke North, where Conservatives have been campaigning hard.
Good morning, sir. How are you doing? I'm the Conservative Party candidate. I was just quickly checking if I might be lucky to get your vote on this occasion.
The Conservatives are hoping to persuade voters in places like this that getting Brexit done is the first priority. Freed from EU ties, they believe, Britain would unleash its global trading potential. But judging by people like Liz Reid, Jenny Lloyd and John Gibson, it's Labour's left-wing proposals that are cutting through.
I must admit I believe in a lot of their policies or feel that their heart's in the right place. I think we have to be more socially aware nowadays.
I think that the rich seem to be getting richer and the people at the bottom are working just as hard, are in so much debt. It's not a fair division anymore.
What about nationalising electricity, water and broadband?
Yes, I think so. Not the broadband, but utility services, yes, definitely. And I think if it's back into public hands, it'll be much fairer all round.
Labour, also offering free university tuition and free dentistry for all, says it'll pay for the splurge by extra taxes on big companies and the rich. Jonathan Gullis, the Conservative candidate here, is not impressed.
The top 5% that Jeremy Corbyn claims he'll be taxing are simply going to end up moving their money or moving abroad elsewhere.
Battered by austerity, maddened by Brexit, infuriated by sky-high house prices, many Brits seem to have fallen out of love with capitalism. But, says Gullis, any new love affair with Corbynism will end in tears.
Jobs will go, we'll see the economy shrink, and we'll find out just how dangerous Corbynism really is.
Tomorrow's poll may well come down to this. A vote for Brexit or a vote for a seismic leftward shift in the British economy. In Stoke-on-Trent, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
From the National Retail Federation comes this nugget. Consumers this holiday season, the NRF says, are guessing they'll spend, and this is an average now, $1,047.83 on those special someones. That's up 4% from a year ago. You throw in food and travel expenses and just stuff, and you wind up in holiday debt a lot of times, and sometimes willingly so. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has more on that.
Tis the season to spend money.
The holidays are here.
It's time for Kia's Holiday Sticker Sales Event.
When you've crossed Fruit of the Loom off your list, it's time to celebrate. Celebrate!
For a lot of people, it's also a time to stress, says Ted Rossman, an industry analyst with CreditCards.com.
There's definitely a lot of pressure to overspend around the holidays. We've actually found that that's the number one time of year when people feel pressure to overspend.
Several recent surveys have all found the same thing. Americans feel pressure to spend more than they'd like this time of year. Millennials and parents with young kids, most of all.
And it's not just on gifts, although gifts was the largest category, but it's also on food and drinks, on travel, outfits, and even home decor. But a lot of folks are feeling that pressure to spend more than really they have to spend.
Brian Nelson Ford is a financial well-being executive at SunTrust Banks. And he says not only do people feel pressure to spend more than they have, but a lot of people actually spend more than they have. SunTrust's holiday survey found that 68% of Americans plan to put at least half of their holiday spending on credit. Another one from LendingTree found that nearly 20% of people are still paying off holiday bills from last year.
It's just really easy to use credit this time of year. And especially think about holiday shopping. How many people are doing stuff last minute? It's hard to make good financial choices when you're last minute shopping.
Summer Red is an accredited financial counselor who works a lot with low-income families. And she says there is just a huge amount of pressure to keep up with the Joneses. Always, but especially this time of year.
And the really tough thing is you come off the holidays and then you just sort of wake up. It's New Year's Day, you wake up and you realize I spent all of my savings and now I'm starting over. And all I have are gifts that don't look really as exciting now that I'm not in a store with soft lighting and holiday music in the background.
One way to take the pressure off, Brian Nelson Ford says, might be to just talk about it with your family and friends, because chances are they're feeling it too. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today of interest to the flying public and aviation enthusiasts, also Wall Street investors and analysts, I am sure. Boeing has been saying the company's fatally troubled 737 MAX is going to get back into the air before the end of the year. That'd be this year. Today, the head of the Federal Aviation Administration, the guy whose agency has to sign off on the airworthiness certificate, said no, it's not. There are a number of milestones that have to be completed, Steve Dixon told CNBC. If you just do the math, it's going to extend into 2020. Boeing shares today up 0.6% all the same. Okay, we got to go on this Fed, what is it, Wednesday. The Dow Industrial is up 29 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ gained 37 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 up 0.9%. Our media production team includes Sarah Bruguer, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.